I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Even after decades of government assistance, there remain thousands of underserved neighborhoods in this country. Today we'll meet a Black conservative who says improving those struggling communities starts by empowering local leadership and teaching residents how to find solutions to their problems. Then Chiefs cornerback Marcus Peters' national anthem protest led to racist responses against him and the African-American columnist who defended him. That got me wondering, are journalists of color subjected to more abuse than white journalists like me? After that, the latest edition of Statehouse Blend, Missouri. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. What does it take to stop youth violence? Robert Woodson has been pondering that for years as the founder and longtime president of the Center for Neighborhood Enterprise. President Trump apparently considered him for the head job at HUD. That's the Federal Housing and Urban Development Department. Bob Woodson is a conservative who founded the Center for Neighborhood Enterprise back in 1981. He's long favored an approach to community development that favors placing direct control in the hands of community leaders and programs. The center may be best known for its Violence Free Zone program, which is a school-based model that employs a mix of mentoring services, youth development programs, and a young adult advisors program who work full-time in area schools. He's been referred to as the godfather of the neighborhood empowerment movement. He just spoke to the Association of Fundraising Professionals Mid-America chapter, and he's here to speak to us right now. Bob, welcome. So good to have you here.
So pleased to be here.
So when you talk about neighborhood empowerment, you're suggesting that residents take on problems on their own and not rely so much on government programs. Do I have that right?
It is. I'll just give you one quick example. Mm-hmm. In Washington, D.C., there was an area in southeast Washington, a high-crime area called Benning Terrace, where there was two warring gangs. They called them crews. 53 murders in a 5-square-block area in 2 years, and the police were afraid to go in. I had a lot of experience in gang intervention based upon experiences. So I recruited 5 young men who were ex-offenders who had the trust and confidence of law enforcement and the community. And when this 12-year-old boy was killed, I said, you need to go and bring those warring factions to my office. Because they had the trust, they identified 16 young men, 8 on either side, and they came in separate vans to my office. And then we had a meal for them. And then and the young people said, no one has ever asked us to be peaceful.
Huh.
I tell people when they came in, we searched them. They had bulletproof vests on. I say, it's fine to be spirit-filled, but not crazy.
And it worked.
What happened was because they were being inspired by men who had been in that predatory lifestyle, they were inspired to change. And as a result of them coming in, we were able to secure employment from the housing authority. So they went back to remove graffiti, plant grass, to restore the very community that they destroyed.
Hmm.
And as a consequence, hundreds of people poured into the streets when they were fearful before. And so we just took this leadership and redirected it from predatory to make them ambassadors of peace. The consequence has been that we had got them trained for jobs. They were in maintenance. And for 12 years, we didn't have a gang-related murder in that community. And so we learned a lot about how to intervene. And so we've taken those principles and now we've exported them to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the same, and other cities.
You know, Kansas City has a similar program like that. It's the Aim for Peace model that's being used here. I'm wondering, what's so wrong with government programs, Bob?
Well, government programs, as I said to the association members, our approach to problems is to pay trained professionals. We spent about $22 trillion in the last 50 years on programs of aid to poor. 70 cents of every dollar goes not to the poor, but those who who serve poor people, and they asked what problems are fundable, not which ones are solvable. And so they
it's the bureaucracy that winds up growing and being
But they also
nurtured
impose
here.
It on you. The human body is oriented towards health. And so you cure the body by strengthening its own immune system. You don't apply a transplant. And so what you do is we catalyze the community to heal itself, but they need help. But they need the kind of help that comes from within, not the kind that comes from outside.
You've been pushing some of these ideas for decades. You're suggesting they've taken root in some places. Why not in a more widespread kind of way?
Because poor people have become a commodity.
meaning
that if 70 cents of every dollar is going to professional people to serve poor people, they have no incentive to end poverty.
They want to keep the program
going. It's a poverty industrial complex.
Hmm.
And so that's what we've got to change. We've got to just alter the incentives. In other words, a friend of mine is building a cabin in Wisconsin. His electrician has one leg and his carpenter is a drunk. Their value to him is their skill. But mm-hmm. if he was running a disabilities association, their value to him is their disability.
So why hasn't your thinking taken root?
I think it's unusual. It's in our market economy, we accept innovation from untutored sources.
Mm-hmm.
No one's going to ask Bill Gates whether he has a degree. But in our social economy, certification is synonymous with qualification. And so we don't seem to be willing to accept solutions from untutored people. That's the biggest barrier that we face. And also, they're just powerful economic incentives that mitigate against giving poor people agency, give them the capacity to help themselves, because if they are able to do it cheaper, then why do we keep funding these big bureaucracies?
Mm-hmm. But if you were the ruler of the world, we'd be doing it a whole lot cheaper, it sounds like.
We really do. And that's what we're trying to do now. We're trying to say to the Trump administration, they should shift gears and really direct money at the local level and defund some of these bureaucracies that have failed over the years.
Hmm. How open are they to hearing that?
We'll see. Right now, they're a little preoccupied with with other things.
Other issues, yeah.
But I think conservatives have a predisposition to support this because their strategic interest is compatible with that of the poor. Conservatives don't benefit from having poverty. Taxes are high. Services are expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't profit from it. So I think the poor have strategic interests that are compatible with the conservatives.
You know, Clarence Page, the longtime columnist for the Chicago Tribune, says your approach can work wonders. I'm wondering if you can give us another example or two of neighborhood empowerment programs, Bob, that you found to be particularly effective over the years.
Well, there's one that your listeners can go on YouTube and turn in Bertha Gilkey 60 Minutes. Right there in St. Louis, in the Cochran Public Housing in the 80s, when the residents were given control of this 9-story complex, it was overrun with drug addicts. When the residents took charge of it, expelled the drug dealers, put in strong incentives, and gave the authority. People paid their rents on time. People policed their units. They cleaned it up. Morley Safer did a 23-minute special on Cochran. There were market-rate housing built right across the street from Cochran because crime was there. One quick example of a unique way they do it, they put in a new laundry room. Under housing authorities' control, it was vandalized and people were afraid to go there. The residents got together and said, who is the toughest boy in this project? Tommy Jones. Why don't we appoint his mother as monitor of the laundry room? Problem solved.
Huh. Took care of it right away.
It did. But these are the kind of common sense solutions that grassroots people devise that are unusual and unorthodox. But as this segment said, and there are two or three other projects like that around the country. Kimmy Gray in Washington, D.C., they sent about 680 kids from public housing to college. just about wiping out the teen pregnancy rate, drove out the drug dealers.
Because in all these cases, you're suggesting, Bob, the residents themselves have buy-in. They take responsibility. And what you're suggesting, if I'm following you correctly, is that government programs take away that responsibility. The bureaucrats take that on, in theory, and leaving the residents with really no buy-in here at all.
That's exactly. And Jack Kemp, we enlisted Jack Kemp to get the laws changed, because under the so we had 7 amendments to the Housing Act passed as a consequence of Jack Kemp. We recruited Walter Fauntroy, liberal Democrat from Washington, Bill Armstrong, conservative from Colorado, with Alan Dixon from Illinois, and it passed 93-0 in the Senate and 430 in the House, and Reagan signed it into law, flanked by myself and resident leaders.
I was going to say, over the years, you've had support from a lot of Democrats, including, for a long time, John Conyers of Michigan.
Absolutely. John Conyers in Michigan, because I really consider my political philosophy radical pragmatism.
Meaning?
Meaning that I just want what works. Most Americans are non-ideological. Most of us just want stuff that works,
right?
Regardless of who authors it or who supports it.
Bob Woodson is my guest, a conservative who founded the Center for Neighborhood Enterprise back in 1981. If you have questions for Bob, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Tell us about the violence-free zone program. What is it, and how does it work, Bob?
Well, what we do, for instance, if you have a school of 1,000 kids, let's take a violent school in South Division, they are controlled by 10%. So what we do is we recruit young adults from that same community who used to be predatory, but who, through God's grace, they have begun redeemed and transformed.
Mm-hmm.
Then they are put work for a national nonprofit that are operating partners in the city. They then are working full-time in the schools, and they become moral mentors and character coaches to the kids. They circulate in the halls so that when they connect with this 10%, and when you change and transform the 10%, then you change the whole school.
You know, I'm just struck by this notion of the idea of this lack of community empowerment that seems rampant across the country right now, residents not having buy-in to neighborhood problems, residential issues, whatever it is. You know, we are bowling alone in this society, as the saying goes. People of all races are pulling back from community engagement. You're suggesting just the opposite needs to occur. That means a whole cultural shift of one kind or another. How do you begin to push that boulder downhill?
Well, as I go around the country, the center, we've just changed our name to the Woodson Center, but we find no lack of interest in it. We're in 39 states. We've trained about 3,000 grassroots leaders. There's an eagerness to engage. We just don't have the means and the resource to do it. But also, it's not really reported. You know, and so what we're trying to do.
Meaning some of these programs occur outside the radar screen, under the radar screen.
In other words, the qualities that make these grassroots leaders effective makes them invisible.
Yeah.
Because they're not whining and complaining. They're not marching on anyone. They're not engaging in protest. They're busy serving their community.
Mm-hmm.
And so the challenge is, they're not looking for you. You have to find them. So if you've got to be like a Geiger counter and go out and look for them actively. And when you do with what the marketplace does to an entrepreneur. You provide not only capital, but you also provide assistance because, you know, commercial entrepreneurs tend to be bad bookkeepers. But in our market economy, we compensate for that by bringing not only capital, but training. So what I said to the group today, that as funders, you need to fund people who provide assistance, professional assistance to these grassroots leaders, but the professionals must be on tap and not on top.
Well, how difficult is it for these funders to find these people if they're so hard to find? How do they locate them?
Well, they're not hard to find. They just have to ask the right people. I was invited into Milwaukee, Wisconsin, having known no one on the streets. in the 90s, I went to hairdressers, barbershops, and I asked people, where do they turn to in times of trouble and in conflict? And they gave me the name of three people. And once I knocked on their doors, they introduced me to 10. And then from there, I met 30.
Really?
And so I introduced this process to the group here. But there are knowledgeable people in these communities. You just have to ask them.
Huh. And once you ask them, you can locate them and begin to figure out who's who.
Absolutely.
But that means doing some homework here, though.
Doing some homework. But also, we went to 7 cities throughout the country, and we let people know that we were looking for examples of what works and why. I gave an example of a mother who raised 2 daughters for 3 years in a homeless shelter and sleeping in the back of her car. And the kids studied by the light of her cell phone. Well, the girls graduated high school valedictorian and salutatorian and started as sophomores because they took so many advanced placement courses.
Hmm.
This mom is the real anti-poverty expert.
Mm-hmm.
So what I said to the funders, we should let people know we're looking for you.
Hmm.
Ask neighbors, ask reporters, ask police, ask anyone. Do you know of people that fit this profile? If so, we want to hear about them.
Just a final point. After all these years in the vineyards here, if you will, what keeps you from getting discouraged?
That question was asked by Senator Packwood of Mother Teresa as he walked with her in the streets of Calcutta when he said, you're only able to help 300 and there are 3 million that need your help. And she said to him, and I'll never forget it, God does not require success of me, just faithfulness.
Hmm.
Because if I'm faithful in what I do, he will determine what success looks like.
It's a nice way to end. I appreciate that. That's Bob Woodson, who founded the Center for Neighborhood Enterprise in 1981. He just spoke in Kansas City. What a pleasure to have you here. Thanks so much.
Enjoyed it.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with the Stars' Janae Osterhout about some columns she wrote about Chiefs cornerback Marcus Peters' decision to sit during the national anthem and how people reacted to it. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we met a climate scientist who preaches global warming to skeptical Christians. Also, baseball statistician Bill James and his daughter shared why they wrote about a century-old crime spree. Just an amazing story. You can find those conversations at kcur.org. Tomorrow, we broadcast live from Lenexa's new Civic Center, find out how the development is helping local businesses, and we'll meet a few entrepreneurs who already are jumping in. Well, when the Stars' Janae Osterhout penned a column defending Chiefs cornerback Marcus Peters' decision to sit during the national anthem, reactions on Facebook erupted. She was called a baboon, a knuckle-dragger, and all manner of slurs. Jeff from Montana chimed in with this, "You are exactly why tall trees and ropes were made." All for a column defending Marcus Peters' quiet protest during the national anthem. Now a conversation about reactions to the writings of journalists of color. With us are Janae Osterhout, again a columnist for The Star. She just returned to Kansas City following a year-long Nieman Fellowship out at Harvard. Janae, good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you.
Karen Phillips is a columnist for the New York Daily News, focusing on race, sports, and social issues. He joins us by Skype from Atlanta. Karen, welcome. Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Janae, how surprised were you by this reaction this column on Marcus Peters received?
Not very.
Really?
No.
Because?
This isn't unusual, actually. I think columnists of color have probably been enduring this always. If you ask Louis Duguid, who worked at The Star for 40 years, he can pull out tape cassettes of this type of commentary.
But you were called a baboon, a knuckle-dragger? Are you kidding me?
I mean, I've been called a nigger many, many, many times before that.
Really?
So, I mean, this is not new. I think what's new is that, you know, white liberal America is suddenly shocked, probably because Trump is in office and now everyone has to face the fact that racism is real. But I think for columnists of color and writers of color, this is not really all that shocking. The only thing that I would say that's changed is more and more people are willing to sign their names. But people signed their names before. My life was threatened before when Obama was in office, and that person was happy to say their name. Like, so I do think people are more emboldened and brazened, but I actually don't think this is new.
Karen Phillips, what's surprising to this to you?
Nothing at all.
Really?
This is just a part of my job every day. Like Janae said, this isn't new. This has been going on forever. It's just that people maybe are finally starting to pay attention. But yeah, this is a very old song that we've been singing.
You know, it's interesting just hearing you two talk. I wrote columns. I write columns for the paper. Those columns are often criticized. But no one has ever come close to suggesting what Jeff from Montana wrote to Janae. And I'm quoting here, "You are exactly why tall trees and ropes were made." So I guess the obvious question, Janae, do you think people say different things to a writer of color than to me, a good old white male?
Of course. And I'm not saying that, you know, white writers don't have their life threatened. We've had several writers at the Star who've had their life threatened who are white. However, I feel like if you're a writer of color and if you're a woman, if you're any minority or marginalized group, the people who come after you are largely bigoted people who will not attack your talent, but attack your color, your gender, your orientation. Like, that is what they go for. And more often than not, they're just mad that a person of color is in their paper and has a voice and has any type of intelligence.
You know, Karen, I'm just thinking that in this era of social media that we all live in, that maybe has changed the math here when it comes to the kinds of responses people feel emboldened to write and to say to other people. Am I seeing that right?
Yeah, there's something to speak to that, because people can hide behind, you know, the egg-shaped Twitter avatars, or they can put up a fake photo of someone else that's not necessarily them, to where it may be them and their thoughts, but it's not actually their face or their government name. So people love to get tough behind a screen name when there's when what they're actually saying and what they actually believe, they would never say to you face to face or in person.
Well, what's the thing you've written most recently for the New York Daily News, Karen, that's lit it up in terms of reaction and maybe outrageous reaction?
Well, basically everything I write lights things up, because I write about race and sports and social issues like every time I sit in front of my computer. So this is a daily occurrence to me. So I'm not really fazed or bothered by it. But last week, there were some things I wrote about. I wrote about the Jemele Hill situation at ESPN twice. Went after ESPN two times last week. And I also wrote a column about the situation with Michael Bennett, what happened in Las Vegas, that talked about his situation, what happened to Anthony Morrow here in Georgia, a former NBA player who was a free agent now, who was pulled over for no reason. And for the video that came out this year from last year about the Cobb County police officer that pulled over a white woman and told her, you know, "Oh, we only shoot black people. You have nothing to worry about." And how police are giving black people and black athletes the fuel and the reason for why they're protesting is because they are continually doing things like this in public that are coming out, which is why you have people sitting down and raising their fists during the national anthem.
I was going to say, Karen, you said you don't dwell on these comments. I'm wondering, how do you handle it? Because it's got to affect you.
It doesn't. I'm a black man in America. If you let things like this affect you, you'll never do anything positive in life, period. You just have to be numb to it. I mean, everyone isn't, I guess this is a funny way to say it, but everyone isn't built like me, and I understand that. But from my life experiences, this doesn't bother me because I understand what this is. I understand what my job is. I understand what I signed up for. But I was an African-American studies major in undergrad. So I studied what this country is and what we are and what we've really done and what we like to hide and sweep under the rug. And I also understand how this social media thing works. And I'm not scared of Twitter tough guys, because if you say it online, 99.999% of the time means you won't say it in real life.
Huh, that's interesting. Janae, how do you handle it?
I would agree with him. I won't say that I'm 100% numb. Like, overall, I am used to it, and it's been happening literally since I was an intern. And as far as dealing with racism, I've been dealing with that since I was a child.
And when you were an intern at the Star, I mean, you were a kid. I mean, you were a young woman, you know, dealing with stuff that's pretty heavy duty.
It's part of the, like, Caron said, it's part of the job. And, you know, there are days when occasionally I'll get upset and take a breather, but then I remember what I'm here for and what the job is, and I get over it. I shake it off, because that's what they want. They want to silence us. They want to feel like they have the power to shut us down and prevent us from speaking truth to power. And even if I have a bad day and I take a moment and I'm upset because somebody wants to lynch me or they threaten my life, I still write a column the next day. I still go ahead and push through because I'm not here for anybody to shut down. This is my voice.
Huh. Karana, you made the point that sports reporters with a beat can't really comment on these protests like columnists like you and Janae can. Why is that? Explain that to our listeners and why that discrepancy exists.
Well, if you're just a beat writer for a pro team or a college team or even high school, we've seen things like this happen on the high school level. Your job is to really just report the news, what happens, who won, you know, the pillars of journalism, who, what, when, where, why. That's your job. There may be feature stories for you to dig into with situations that may happen, but to actually opine and give opinion, that's not necessarily your job. But for columnists like myself and Janae, this is why we're here, to do what we do and to give voice and to give reason and to shed light on situations like these.
You know, Janae, when Jeff from Montana wrote you the note, or I guess it was on Facebook, about you are exactly why tall trees with ropes were made, do you respond to that stuff?
Jeff sent me a direct email. That was direct to my inbox.
An email.
And it was one of the very first messages I got as soon as the Peter's thing went online. It was one of the first responses I got. It gave me pause only because my life had been threatened before I left the Star, back when the stuff in Mizzou happened.
Yeah.
But I just sent it to my editor just in case. And then they decided what we should do next. But
does the Star ever turn that stuff over to the authorities and say,
yes,
hey, we have reporters being threatened here, we got to do something?
Yes, absolutely. The police get involved. But, you know, as the night went on, it went from 10 emails to 20 emails to 30 emails to hundreds of emails to thousands of Facebook comments and, mm-hmm, you know, Twitter responses as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then the phone calls rolled in. And I think people get so shocked and, I don't know, kind of like tragedy porn, like they want to keep reading and hearing the racist comments over and over again, that they overlook, to me, what is the more important comments, the ones that are passively racist, but, you know, from people who don't think they're racist. Things like, oh, you know, it's so sad the Star had to let you back because of affirmative action.
Yeah.
Or I can't believe they sent you to Harvard or Harvard let you go. To me, I'm more frustrated by those kind of comments because no one is upset at those at all. But those are the everyday, mm-hmm, microaggressions that Black people deal with. Those, mm-hmm, that's like dealing with privilege directly.
Karen, do you respond?
Sometimes. Depends on my mood for that day.
Yeah.
If I'm really busy, no. Some days I feel like being a jerk and giving it right back. But which is funny, the way I do it is that I'll quote your tweet. I usually do mine. I don't really deal with Facebook like that or emails. But I treat my Twitter mentions like my front yard sometimes. If you come in my front yard yelling, I'm liable to say something back. So on certain days, maybe 2 or 3 days a month, I will quote your tweet if you say something stupid and obliterate you, and then let it stay up there for about 10 minutes so people can laugh at you, and then I'll block you so that you can't say anything back.
You know, are we going backwards here? I mean, this country takes pride in this idea that we're, in this notion that we're moving forward on civil rights, that we're going the right direction, that we're making progress. And after talking to you two for 10 minutes, I'm not sure I'm quite convinced of that. Karen, what do you think?
Your question was, are we going backwards? My question is, have we ever really progressed?
Amen.
Okay.
And I think that's the question we need to ask. Because if you really sit down and ask Black people as a whole, have we really progressed? My answer is very minutely. Now, we have these ups and downs where you can point to like Obama and things of that magnitude and say, yes, there's progress. But then I can also point to Flint, Michigan. And I'm from Saginaw, and Flint, Michigan is down the street. And I can point to this last election, or I can point to a guy who was the face of the NFL 3 years ago, and he can't get a job, and say, if we're really having progress as a country, how are these things still happening?
Colin Kaepernick you're talking about, yeah.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Janae?
I agree with everything he just said. I mean, I think people like to use these landmark moments, like Obama, and anytime anybody high profile and black has any position of power, they're like, oh yeah, we've made progress. But systemic racism never quit. Like, they just start to find other ways to enforce it, whether we're talking about redlining or bank loans or, you know, application discrimination. I mean, there's just, it's never really quit. So yeah, I think we've made some progress. I'm sitting here across from you, and you know, that probably wouldn't have happened some decades and right. decades and decades ago. But I do feel like it's just, you know, maybe we're one stop forward on the train, not 10 stops forward. Like, yeah. this is, I don't know that this train ever quits. Like, we're chipping away constantly at supremacy. This is like a long, long ride.
You know, Karen, you've been writing extensively on these protests by black athletes, but you've also commented, if equality and fairness are the goal, then it's going to take people of all shades and colors working together to obtain it. Would you say that applies to the journalists who cover athletes as well?
Yes, but there's the conundrum in that, which I understand. I understand there are sports journalists out here who just love sports, and this is a profession that they've always wanted to do. And they just wanted to report on and be the best sports reporter or writer that they could be. And now all this social issue stuff is happening and they don't want to cover it. I get that. I understand that. But they should also understand that this is now a part of their job and this is what they signed up for. So sooner or later, they're going to have to decide if they're going to go all in on this or maybe find another career choice. Because as much as the stick to sports mantra that people love to say, that doesn't really exist anymore. And this is all coming together. So at some point, you're going to have to address it because it's not going anywhere anytime soon.
You know, I'm wondering, Karen, from your perspective, you know, Colin Kaepernick, you know, made the first protest sitting, kneeling during the national anthem. Now Marcus Peters of the Chiefs has done it. Many other players have done it as well. How effective are these protests?
They're effective in terms of grabbing people's attention to having us on a radio show and talking about it like this. But I did a feature story a couple months ago for the Daily News where we looked at the past year in different sports with protests and things happening like this. And I spoke with Malcolm Jenkins, star cornerback for the Philadelphia Eagles, who's been at the head of all of this. And what he was saying is that a lot of guys are mobilizing, they're educating themselves, and while they understand that the protests are what grabs people's attention, what they're really doing is trying to affect legislature and policy, and they're making trips to D.C., and they're getting everybody in one accord and in line to really fight this battle.
Mm-hmm. Janae, how effective do you think Marcus Peters' protest has been here in the Kansas City area?
I think it's effective as far as getting people to talk about it and have dialogue about it. I think what is sad to me is people are overlooking the other things that Marcus Peters is doing in his community. He's not simply protesting the anthem. He is actually affecting change in Oakland as far as mentoring him and Marshawn Lynch and another football player. They have an organization where they go out into the community.
You don't read much about that, though.
No, people don't care because they want to make it seem like these athletes are just spoiled rich babies, and they're all, you know, Colin Kaepernick didn't just kneel. He's out there educating people. So I guess I get frustrated by the idea that they're simply sitting. They're actually, most of them are doing much more than that and going out into their community and raising awareness and education and mobilizing.
Well, I'm wondering if the two of you would come back and join us again sometime. This is a really good conversation. I really appreciate you both taking the time. Janae Osterheld, a columnist for The Star, just back from a Nieman Fellowship at Harvard. Karen Phillips, a columnist for the New York Daily News. Really appreciate you both taking the time and being so candid with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Last week, the Missouri General Assembly held its annual veto session and ended up overriding nothing. That means there's still no source for the $35 million needed to fund in-home and nursing care for 8,000 disabled Missourians. For now, the funding has been cut off. This week on State House Blend Missouri, host Brian Ellison talked with House Budget Committee Chair Scott Fitzpatrick, a Republican lawmaker from Cassville who's tasked with finding a solution.
How are you approaching that?
Listen, you know, I guess the first thing, I was not in favor of the final version of House Committee Bill 3, and I supported the governor's veto.
But, and yet you did give a chance for it to be discussed on the floor as a gesture to some of your colleagues who wanted it discussed.
Yeah, I did. That was a difficult thing for me to decide to do because I definitely did not like the bill. But it ended up passing with the support of all the Democrats and a minority of Republicans in the House by one vote on the adoption motion, you know, and that was what it was. So there have been some discussions since the veto took place about how best to move forward on this issue. And, you know, as the House budget chairman, I included in the House version of the budget all the funding to be able to go to maintain the services at their current level. Our budget was built on passing a repeal of the renter's portion of the property tax credit, which is also known as circuit breaker. And it's basically a program that's designed to reimburse seniors for their expenses associated with paying tax on their home. That was the thing that I had proposed in the House, and it passed the House, but the Senate did not concur with my plan.
What would have been so wrong with keeping that compromise bill with overriding the governor's veto?
Well, there were a few problems with the bill. Number one, the veto session took place on September 13th. The bill stated that on or before September 1st of 2017, the director of the Department of Revenue shall. So if the bill didn't go into effect until September 13th, then the dates didn't work. So that was a major mechanical problem with the bill. Number two, the problem is that any transfer of money from one state fund to another state fund requires an appropriation. And to me, ceding that authority as the General Assembly to the executive branch is an unconstitutional delegation of our power to the governor.
So your concern was about the process as much as about the actual merits of that being
right.
A good source for the funds.
Yeah, and if you read the governor's veto letter, they said we can't transfer the money because you didn't give us the appropriations to do it. So really all it did was it created a $35.4 million shortfall to the general revenue fund, which would have required additional withholds by the governor from the rest of the budget.
So that wouldn't have worked in the governor's view, in your view, and obviously in the majority of the party's view. So now here we are. The instructions that came from the House Speaker and the Senate President to you and to Senator Cunningham are that you're supposed to put together a plan in 3 weeks to solve this problem. Do you think that's realistic?
Well, I think it's definitely realistic that we will either have a plan or we won't in 3 weeks. If that makes sense, I think that Senator Cunningham and I could come to an agreement on how the best way to do this is in 15 minutes. I think that getting the other people involved who would have to allow the bill to A, even come to a vote, but B, pass it, is another challenge.
Give us an outline. What do you think could be done to solve this problem?
Well, I think that the parameters that we've set is that it needs to be something that is going to create real and ongoing savings so that this is not a one-time fix. And then in January, here we are dealing with this problem again. The Senate has, at this point, shown an interest in trying to come up with, if you want, you can call it circuit breaker light if you want to, a pared down version or a different version of the original bill that I had introduced that reformed the property tax credit. And so as opposed to, for instance, cutting off just the renters from that program, tying it more to you know, a level of income that's consistent with the poverty level, or maybe raising the age necessary to qualify, because, you know, since this program was created, life expectancy has increased, right? I mean, those are things that that can be discussed. Another issue was currently, you know, a homeowner, when he or she applies for the credit, they're eligible to receive up to the actual amount of the property taxes paid, or $1,100, whichever is more. A renter is allowed to receive up to 20% of the rent they paid. Basically, the statute says that up to 20% of the rent is paid is constituted as property tax.
So now, before we get too far into the weeds, what I hear you saying is that you think the solution to finding the funds for this in-home and nursing care is to go back to that circuit breaker tax credit and tweak it to make it to kick off another $35 million that you could then spend on this.
I think that that is a much more known territory for the journalists. There have been a lot of discussions about, even towards the end of session, about what could be more palatable in that space, in the circuit breaker space. Okay, I know where my caucus is. I know that I can pass out of the House of Representatives something between repealing the renter's portion of circuit breaker and nothing on circuit breaker. And so I know that I have a window in the House of Representatives of that, in that lane. So this is an issue that's familiar to the General Assembly. I think it's more realistic to look at that as some form of that as a solution, as opposed to something that we've never approached at all before. I know that if we tried to go after some other item, there has been little debate over, that it will be a much more difficult thing to accomplish.
Will the governor, do you think, call another special session for this purpose, or do you have the three-quarters votes you would need to actually have the legislature call itself into special session?
Well, part of the plan is, to the extent that they want to, is to invite at least a couple of Democrats from both sides of the building, so both the Senate and the House, to give their input on what would be, in their opinion, the least offensive way to approach this. That doesn't mean that we expect them to vote for the bill or that they will love the bill, but something that could get us to a point where, if the governor wouldn't call a special session on it, the Democrats would have the opportunity to at least sign a special session call to allow that bill to be debated.
To take a step back from this particular line in the budget, you know, back in the regular session, you received a lot of praise, bipartisan praise, I would even say, for your work on the budget. And that's a budget that came with a lot of cuts to reductions over previous years, to higher education, to social services. Are you concerned, as you look to the 2018 budget, 2019 budget, about the long-term viability of the state budget? Is this system working? Do we have sufficient revenues for the kinds of expenses that a state like Missouri is going to have?
I think if revenues are growing, if revenues on average grow, you know, 3 to 4 to 5% a year, that should be sufficient for us to maintain and, you know, operating the government, right? Because if you think about it, do you or I, or, you know, most people get more than a 3 to 4% raise every year, cost of living adjustment? And I think the answer is, you know, a lot of people live with that or less than that as an increase to their own budget every year. Now, obviously, the cost of health care has increased significantly over the last several years. The growth and not only just the cost of delivering care, but as a result of an increase in the number of people who have enrolled in Medicaid in the state over the last 5 years, the cost of the Medicaid program has gone up erratically. And my hope is that will stabilize. Hopefully that, you know, we can have stabilization in the cost of Medicaid and sufficient revenue growth, and the two things combined will allow us to make better and more strategic investments in the state budget to hopefully help improve the economy moving forward.
We do invite you, our guest, to choose some music that you think has an important word to speak on the state of the Missouri General Assembly today. Is there a particular song that you think captures where we are at this moment?
Oh, man, you're putting me on the spot. How about American Pie? Everybody loves American Pie, right?
Everybody loves American Pie. It's Representative Scott Fitzpatrick. He's the chair of the House Budget Committee, a Republican from Shell Knob. Actually lives in Cassville now. And thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Love to come back sometime.
I'm Brian Ellison. Thanks for listening.
So bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. And then good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die. Did you write the book of love, and do you have faith in God above? If the Bible tells you so,
listen a little more of that. To hear the full conversation, subscribe to State House Blend Missouri wherever you get your podcasts and on the NPR One app. You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, we broadcast live from Lenexa's new public market. We'll meet a few local entrepreneurs eager to set up shop. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett produce our show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.
The music died. I started singing bye bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. Them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye and singing, this'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die.